I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, Arianna Huffington. She's joined in conversation by Power to Fly's Catherine Zaleski. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Arianna Huffington and Catherine Zaleski.
I'm so honored, really, to welcome all of you here tonight for this program with Arianna Huffington and Catherine Zaleski. Arianna Huffington is the co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group and the author of 15 books. In May 2005, she launched the Huffington Post, a news and blog site that quickly became one of the world's most widely read, linked to, and frequently cited media brands on the internet. In 2012, the site won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. Arianna has been named to the Time magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people and the Forbes most powerful women list. Originally from Greece, she moved to England when she was 16 and graduated from Cambridge University with a master's in economics. At 21, she became president of the famed debating society, the Cambridge Union. She serves on numerous boards, including the Center for Public Integrity and the Committee to Protect Journalists. And we're here tonight to celebrate her 15th book, her latest book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time, all about the science, history, and mystery of sleep. Tonight, Arianna is joined in conversation by Catherine Zaleski, co-founder and president of Power to Fly, the global platform that matches businesses with women who can work from anywhere. Since launching in August 2014, Power to Fly has enabled over 75,000 women across 143 countries to connect with Fortune 500 companies and fast-growing startups. Catherine got her big break at the age of 24 when she was hired to be the sixth employee of the Huffington Post, where she had a front row seat as the site's news editor for its first 4.5 years. So please join me to welcome Arianna Huffington and Catherine Zaleski.
Hi. So you can see I did my homework because I worked for Arianna for 4.5 years. And I'm probably the only interviewer on this book tour who can actually vouch for your sleep schedule. What happens when you don't sleep enough? What happens when you get a lot of sleep? But anyway, you were wonderful to work for either way. So, but I was there, I think it was in 2007, when you really had the impetus to write the book. So tell us about that. Why did you decide to write an entire book on sleep?
Well, first of all, I just love the fact that we're doing this conversation together. You were a phenomenal news editor and truly very much essential to the growth of the Huffington Post.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you said, Catherine, in 2007, 2 years into us building the Huffington Post, I collapsed from sleep deprivation and broke my cheekbone on the way down. And that was the beginning of this journey of reevaluating my life and also looking around and seeing that there were thousands of casualties of burnout.
Right.
And that burnout is really a kind of the disease of our modern civilization. Mm-hmm. And when I went around talking about my last book, Thrive, I saw that everybody really wanted to talk about sleep. It was like the universal theme. People may not have wanted to meditate or be mindful or do yoga or redefine success, but everybody has a relationship with sleep.
Yeah, because we spend half our lives doing it.
Yes. Well, not but, half, but a third.
Oh, yeah. Depends. Right. But what do you think has happened with sleep where we've sort of forgotten? I mean, you talk about there's this sleep revolution, there was the industrial revolution, now we have the information revolution, things have changed with our relationship to sleep. So.
Yes, what happened is that, and that's what I tried to track, you know, in the book, to explain why did we start devaluing and dismissing sleep? And why does it matter? Because even though the second part of the book is about the tools and techniques and how can you get a really good night's sleep, I urge everybody not to jump to that part. Because I feel it's imperative that we understand why sleep matters in a very profound way. Not just like, yes, we understand sleep matters, but all the latest amazing science of why it matters. And also the history of why did we start scorning and dismissing it. And that's what dates back to the first Industrial Revolution. When we thought that we could treat human beings like machines. And the goal of machines is to minimize downtime. But human beings are not machines. And in fact, I think the myth of creation is kind of a wonderful metaphor that, you know, God worked very hard and created heaven and earth. It took 6 days. And then she took the seventh day off.
I think
that is a very powerful message. I mean, after all, God is omnipotent, so theoretically, God did not have to take a day off.
Right.
So I think it was really a message to us, a message which we have ignored. And that's why I love the whole idea of the Shabbat. Whether you're Jewish or not, I think it's an incredibly profound idea. Kind of disconnecting from your world, disconnecting from your work, and acknowledging that we are more than our jobs. And in a sense, if we don't have a recognition of that, it's much harder to go to sleep. Because it's much harder to let go of the day, to let go of our incompletions, of our worries about the future, if we think that's all we are, kind of a bundle of... our to-do list, our concerns about the future, our responsibilities, instead of recognizing that however magnificent our job, there is still something more magnificent in us. And sleep is a gateway to that mystery.
No, I love it. In the book, you talk about how the Egyptians had sleep temples.
And
you
Greeks.
Talk about And you talked about figures in history that some people... Well, some of them thought they were omnipotent. Some of them could have gotten more sleep. You mentioned like Napoleon maybe could have won Waterloo.
Yes.
Napoleon, that was a good one.
Napoleon was one of the great figures who dismissed sleep, and look what happened to him, you know. He didn't have a good ending.
Let's talk about some characters out there who think they're omnipotent right now who are clearly not getting enough sleep. how does that? We could even predict what do you think is going to happen in November based on certain candidates' sleep profiles, if you will.
Well, you know, I think one of Donald Trump's greatest contributions to our collective cultural life is going to be the fact that he's exhibit A of what happens to a human being when they're sleep deprived. Because, you know, parents, I think, in future generations are going to be showing their children tapes of Donald Trump and saying, if you don't get your sleep, you're going to be like Donald Trump. Because, honestly, he brags that he only needs and gets 4 hours sleep a night, that he sleeps with his phone because he... basically has to regularly retweet Mussolini and other greats. and he displays all the symptoms that the American Academy of Sleep Medicine describes as symptoms of chronic sleep deprivation, inability to process even short information, outbursts of anger, mood swings, paranoid tendencies, constant regurgitation of incoherent Pablo.
This is like, you're writing a campaign ad for whoever the general is.
It sounds like a splash for the Huffington Post.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Catherine I hope is it the is. Master of splashes.
Yeah. Those were insaner times. So let's talk about some politicians that have gotten enough sleep. You talk about Winston Churchill in the book, which was very interesting.
Yes, Winston Churchill came up with the term power nap. And he really believed that if you had a nap in the middle of the day, it gave you, in a way, 2 days. It kind of restored you and reset your day. And he did win the Second World War, so he knew something.
He did, but he didn't have an iPhone. So yes. What do you think? I mean, yes.
Well, that's actually a big problem. I think we talked about the connection between our sleep crisis and the first industrial revolution, but it's really the third industrial revolution, the digital revolution, that has turned us all into addicts to our technology and to our devices, that has made it so much harder to disconnect and go to sleep. And that's why it requires really convincing ourselves of the importance of sleep before we are going to be willing to turn off our devices. At least I recommend 30 minutes before we turn off the lights. And now, if you are at the moment sleeping with your phone, how many of you are sleeping with your phone by your bed?
Aye.
About half, would you say?
Yeah. Well, the ones that are telling the truth.
So, okay, that's like that's of all the tools and techniques in the book, that's the most important one. Charge your phone as far away from your bed as you can, ideally in another room, because you need that transition. Mm-hmm. Those of you who are parents, like Catherine and me, know that you don't put your little 2-year-old daughter in bed without a transition. You know, you give her a bath, you sing her a lullaby, you put her in her PJs. We don't do any of that to ourselves. We just literally are on our phones until the last moment, then we turn off the light. And our bodies are exhausted, but our brains are still going. Mm-hmm. So even if we fall asleep, our brains wake us up in the middle of the night. So really, even if all you cared about is your job and your productivity, you're going to be infinitely more productive. If you establish a little transition to sleep, with microscopic steps, I don't believe in starting in a big way, but taking tiny steps, like 5 minutes before you're going to turn off the lights, turn off your devices and charge them outside the bedroom. And then little by little, you develop a full little ritual.
Well, the book has a good 12-step program in there, really.
Yes.
But you're doing this at Huffington Post. The nap pods have become famous. And what are the things? There's people in the audience that are obviously running companies. It's a productivity issue.
It is.
To really make sure people are sleeping. So
we have two nap rooms at the Huffington Post. And when we first launched them in 2011, there was a lot of skepticism. People were reluctant to be seen going into a nap room in the middle of the day, in the middle of the city that never sleeps, New York, in the middle of a bustling newsroom. Now they're perpetually full. We need to open a third one. And also, we have certain ground rules in terms of our relationship with technology. Like at the end of each day, we let all our employees know that they are not expected to be available and on email after hours. Wow. If there is something urgent, we'll call them or text them. And we really believe that this gives us the best quality of employees, of their talents, of their energy, when they come back in the morning recharged. Because you can come to the office and be completely zombie-like and not really engaged in your work and not really creative. It's not about hours at your laptop. It's about the energy you bring to it and the level of creativity. And all these are degraded.
Right.
When we are exhausted.
Yeah. No, you talk about in the book how we've formed this relationship with sleep where it's macho to not sleep. So there's almost this industrial complex that gets us to have more Ambien and more, to convince us that we need to be drugging ourselves. So it's very interesting. The whole Starbucks on every corner. And
And, you know, I love coffee, but the question is, having coffee after 2 p.m. to keep you going is what then interferes with your sleep cycle. And increasingly, I was with Travis Kalanick this afternoon, who is the founder and CEO of Uber, because we've partnered in a campaign against drowsy driving. And he was telling me how when he was a young entrepreneur, he thought, as you said, that it was the macho thing to do, to stay up all night. He said, I had failure after failure after failure. Once somebody succeeds, people forget the failures along the way. And he said, now I realize that if I don't get enough sleep, I'm not as effective at running Uber. And that's the message that we need to get out there, that sleep is a performance enhancer. It's not like you give up sleep in order to be super productive. You give up sleep and you degrade your productivity. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewing today Andre Iguodala from the Golden State Warriors. Any Golden State Warriors fans here? Well, he attributes his MVP status and the success of his team to the fact that he changed his sleep habits and that he gets a full 8 hours and that he protects his sleep as the biggest thing he needs to do every night to be at his best. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we need. We need people who are very successful at what they do, who kind of really testify to the power of this completely legal performance-enhancing drug.
My favorite example in the book was when you talked about how Larry Page came up with Google in a dream.
I know, don't you love that?
Yeah, it's crazy. I never...
Let It Be was the result of a dream. Do you like that song? In a dream, every single stanza.
Yeah, no, it's great. There's lots and lots of examples inspiring people to go to sleep more in the book.
And also having a little dream book by your bed. I have a dream book and a flashlight, so that I can use it so that I don't have to turn on the lights, because then it helps you remember your dreams more. And it's really also so much fun. You know, now I go to sleep and I kind of have to look forward to whatever is going to be the movie that night.
So do you have any that you want to share with us?
Oh, actually, I have a recurring dream that I love, and it has gotten more and more laborious through the years. And so I'm on this train, and I'm going home to God. Kind of, I believe in God, so I'm very comfortable using that word. But if you are not, you can just say, you're going home. And in my compartment in the train is my family and my closest friends. And the train keeps going on, and there is scenery along the way. And some of it is beautiful scenery, and some of it is ugly scenery, which through the many iterations of this dream I recognize to be a metaphor for my life, that, you know, sometimes there are good things happening and sometimes there are bad things happening, but that as long as I recognize that life is a journey and we keep moving and I don't cling to the good or the bad things, it's an absolutely amazing journey. But there is a catch, which is that if you realize that there's somebody on your train who is kind of a toxic human being, you got to get them off your train at the next station.
That's good.
It's like, basically, it's the ground rule we have at the Huffington Post about hiring, which is no brilliant jerks allowed.
No, really. That's great. Well, I feel like a lot of us have the same recurring dream, but in different stages in life. So not that one. For years, I had a dream that I was always late to an exam at college.
Yes.
Or that I never got into college in the first place. That was always the terrifying dream.
Even after you got into college.
Oh, even after I got into college, and you know, I never even showed up for my SATs or there was a class. And so, you know, we share a lot of these anxiety
yes.
dreams, which is really interesting that we all sort of do the same thing when we're in our beds alone at night or, you know.
Not with
someone else. Which is actually, yeah. Something else you mentioned in the book.
Actually, that's a very important point. The question of sleeping with a partner. It can be very complicated. And I think this is a conversation we need to have. Because people in America, since I'm Greek, as you probably gathered from my accent, and in Europe it's a little different, but in America there is this assumption that if you don't sleep together every night, no matter whether your partner snores, is sick, wakes up early in the morning, goes to bed with their iPad, no matter how disrupted your sleep is because of your partner, you got to sleep with them. Otherwise, it's some kind of magical proof that you don't love them or that your marriage is on the rocks or you're not having sex. And none of that is true. The worst thing you can do for your relationship is sleep in a way that disrupts your sleep, that does not give you recharging sleep, so you wake up resentful, irritable, tired, and you take it out on your partner. So I highly recommend that the most important thing is you get good sleep, whatever it takes. If it means sleeping in another bedroom, sleep in another bedroom. I was doing a podcast on Sunday, and the host said to me, I like the temperature in a room at 60, my wife likes it at 70. I cannot sleep at 70. I sweat, said I have this terrible night, and I resent my wife, and our sex life has deteriorated. She said, we don't have a second bedroom, but I've built a tent in the terrace.
What I found very interesting is you said that women actually do sleep better after that's the one time women sleep better is after sex,
right.
Which is very interesting. But women sleep, they don't sleep as well if there's a man in their bed. So that
unless they have had sex.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because that totally defied everything about the whole cuddle myth in women. So
yeah.
I thought that was sort of news breaking, but maybe I didn't read it right.
So, you know, they've done all these studies. So they've done all these incredible studies around sleep. Mm-hmm. It's an amazingly fertile science right now, and it's all very new. Because
right, which is crazy.
The first scientific sleep center was founded at Stanford in 1970. And now there are 2,500 scientific sleep centers in this country alone. So we get amazing new scientific findings every week.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, one of the most fascinating ones came out last year, actually, about what happens in the brain during sleep. Because we used to think that sleep was a time of inactivity, and now we have learned that sleep is a time of frenetic activity.
Mm.
And that, in fact, sleep has only two modes. The brain has two modes, either asleep and cleaning up or alert and awake.
Right.
So all the toxins that build in the brain through the day have to be washed away at night during sleep. Otherwise, it's incredibly dangerous. They have now linked the proteins that accumulate between the cells in the brain that lead to Alzheimer's with sleep deprivation. So if you see, there's a connection between the sleep deprivation epidemic and the Alzheimer's epidemic. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm recommending that you read the science chapter, because then it's very convincing about why it matters.
And it's reversible. I mean, you can...
Yes.
If you start, yeah. Well, speaking of toxins in the brain, you talk about teenagers. And how much... I don't have a teenager yet, but you've had teenagers. And you talk about the Dracula hormone.
Yes.
That teenagers literally have a Dracula hormone where they want to stay up all night. But you should let your teenager sleep in the morning.
What's in fact, the teenagers have a different circadian rhythm than we have. So if you ask your teenager to get up at 7 in the morning, it's like asking me to get up at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. So the reason why that matters is because we need to change start times for school, for college classes, and there are whole movements now around the country to do that. Mm-hmm. And we are doing a whole college outreach campaign. We're going to 100 colleges. I'm not going to all of them personally, but I was at Stanford yesterday. I'm going to be at USC tomorrow. I was in Denver on Friday. We really want to reach that demographic because that's the time when all these bad habits are put in place, and we see what's happening now in colleges. It's not just how much their health is affected, right. It's also how much their mental health is affected. They have found that sleep deprivation is at the heart of a lot of the problems in colleges with depression, anxiety, binge drinking. So changing how we view sleep has been incredibly important. We've partnered with many brands that are offering free things from pajamas to earplugs to masks to white noise machines to college students to help them improve their sleep.
And are the administrations there?
We're working with the wellness departments or the mental health departments. It's different in each college, but it's been an amazing campaign that we've been building for the last few months. Mm. And if you go to my Instagram or my Facebook, you'll see kind of pictures of college students. It's just really exciting to see this kind of new awakening around sleep.
Yeah, it's good. I did not sleep for 4 years at college, so I wish your sleep tour had happened then. I was hoping you could give us some very specific tips about how everybody can go to sleep tonight so that we can...
I can give you my personal ritual, but I strongly recommend that you look at all the different techniques and little steps for going to sleep and create your own ritual. You know, try things and see what works for you. But mine is now, 30 minutes before I'm going to go to sleep, turning off all my devices, charging them outside my bedroom, lowering the lights in the bedroom and the bathroom, and having a very hot bath with Epsom salts and flickering candles.
Can you tell us more?
Well, it's like, it's for me, water is like a purification ritual. It like washes away the day. If you don't like baths, you can have a shower. It's just basically the water being like a demarcation line. As the Bible says, the evil of today is enough. What's done is done. What's left undone is left undone and will be done tomorrow. There's nothing I can do about it tonight. And this is the time for me to actually go to sleep and fully recharge. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is, I used to sleep in my gym clothes. And the brain gets confusing messages. Are we going to the gym or are we going to sleep? So now I have, night shirts or PJs or even a T-shirt that is not used for the gym. And temperature in the summer, in the mine is kind of 67 degrees that I love. And in bed, I only read physical books. And I read nothing that has to do with my work. I read nothing about politics or media. I read poetry or philosophy or novels. And if you take the sleep revolution to bed, I will consider it a personal victory if you fall asleep while you are reading it.
Well, I mean, I had lunch with, so it's wonderful to hear that, and I'll practice that tonight. But I had lunch with a woman, an executive today, who said, I can't believe that she can actually sleep so much with the career she's had. Like, how does she actually do it? And I'm sure you get asked that all the time. because you've written 15 books and run a big company and travel all the time. So are you able to keep the schedule, or what happens when you travel? I mean, I know you're always on the road.
Well, first of all, you know, as you can see from my social media, I'm not exactly chilling out under a mango tree. So it's not as if... I think that's really what I want to stress, that when you get enough sleep, you can get more things done because you're more present, you're more alert, you can see shortcuts, mm-hmm. you can solve problems faster. So everything gets better. And you can do more, and most important, if you're running a company, you can see the icebergs before they hit the Titanic. You can see opportunities. You can see red flags. You don't waste time hiring the wrong people. You know, all the things that happen when you are tired that make your life harder. I mean, one of my favorite stories in the book is about FDR. In 1940, there was all this pressure on him to enter the war, mm-hmm. but the American public was very much against it. So he didn't know how to square the circle. He didn't know what to do. So what he did is he went on a naval ship. He took 10 days off and went on a naval ship in the Caribbean to think and refuel. And Eleanor was sending him letters with things like, "I'm so happy to think of you sleeping and refueling." And at the end of these 10 days, he came up with his political masterpiece, which was the Land-Lease Program that allowed America to enter the war. Mm-hmm. We have big problems we're facing, and they're not going to be solved by exhausted, burned-out politicians. You know, people need to go to a deeper place to solve big problems, to come up with big ideas. And that's what is missing. I mean, look at what happened with the financial collapse. You know, the financial sector is notoriously sleep-deprived and exhausted. The Citibank motto used to be, "City never sleeps." Well, maybe if they had slept, they would have seen the icebergs before they hit the Titanic. I mean, you had executive after executive who said, "I had no idea." Yeah. Well, where were you? Burnt out and missing the point.
Well, Goldman Sachs now doesn't let their interns stay past midnight. That's big.
It's significant that companies that were at the center of burnout mm-hmm. are making changes. The tipping point for me came 10 days ago when there was a study by McKinsey in the Harvard Business Review, mm-hmm. and the headline was "The Proven Link Between Effective Leadership and Sleep" by McKinsey. And it walked you through what happens to the prefrontal cortex of the brain where the executive functions are housed when you're sleep-deprived and how degraded they become. And the funniest part was that the article was co-written by their chief learning officer and a woman who was described as a McKinsey sleep specialist. Now, that sounded like an Onion headline. The idea that McKinsey had someone helping executives sleep as opposed to helping executives not sleep is very new. And that's part of the sleep revolution and the tipping point we're going through.
Oh, so you think like we have diversity chiefs now, we're going to have sleep chiefs
soon. We're
going
to have sleep chiefs, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. You also had a great line that the nap room will be the next conference room.
I believe that every workplace is going to have a conference room and a nap room.
Yeah. And hopefully more flexible work schedules.
Definitely.
Too, especially
and
for
you're
women.
You're working on that. That's
yes,
why
yes.
I love what you're
Power
doing.
To fly.
Yes. Power to fly is very much about that. How can you have a sustainable life and be able to combine your work and your life without burning out? That's why I love what you're doing. And
Thank
we're
you.
Working together on it.
Well, it's because you talk a lot about women, actually, and this is what we do, about how women are especially affected by sleep. As they're in the workplace and they're doing work at home.
And that's why I think we see so many women burning out and leaving the workplace. And I feel that this is kind of a feminist issue, that mm-hmm. if women were able to do their jobs in a sustainable way, they would stay and it would be great both for the bottom line and for their lives.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we're taking questions at some point, but, oh gosh,
I'm very eager to ask a question because
it's my sister, everybody.
I'm Catherine's sister, but I have a, I'm the first one. Anyway, I have a question. It's essentially about how to say no so that you can get a lot of sleep. And I know this because I lived with Catherine when she worked at the Huffington Post, and she was six and play. And I know she was so eager to please and so eager, you know, especially when you're just starting out, you just really want to prove yourself. So do you have any advice, especially for people who are ambitious and eager to succeed, on how to say to yourself that you need to step back, but also how to explain to people that you work with that you just need to step back?
That's a fantastic question. And I think learning to say no, whether it's to employers or to friends or to ourselves, is absolutely central to this. And if you think of it, it has to do with what you are saying yes to. So if you put it positively, for me, what's made it easier is I'm saying yes to the way I want to live my life. I want to live my life fully present, bringing vitality and joy to what I'm doing, and gratitude for all the blessings in my life. And when I'm sleep deprived, I don't bring any of these things to my life. I instead bring a cranky, irritable, overreactive, zombie-like human being. And I don't like that part of myself. We all have it, though. So because I'm drawn like a magnet to how I want to be in my life, how I want to show up for my work, for my family, for my friends, it's easy for me to say no. I mean, a friend gave me a great book party last night that you both were at. It was fantastic. I would have loved to then go to dinner with friends whom I hadn't seen for a long time, but I had to get up super early today to start doing a media tour, so I went to bed. Mm-hmm. You may think that's a sacrifice, but trust me, the alternative would have been for me to be completely exhausted through the day and not be really present and enjoying being here with Catherine and with you. And that's not worth it. So if you reframe saying no, that it's not really saying no, it's really saying yes to the things that matter to you and to the things you prioritize, everything changes. And I have one other little rule, which is, you know how often you start projects in your mind about things you want to do, but you never start them or complete them? And these things drain energy. Even if you don't do anything about them, they drain energy in your head. So I do a regular inventory, and I have this little motto that says you can complete a project by dropping it. So that's how I completed becoming a good skier, for example. I really wanted to become a good skier. I'm a lousy skier. I realized I would never really invest enough energy and time to become a good skier. So I decided the project is complete. And now when I go skiing with my daughters or friends, you know, I sit by the fire, drink hot chocolate, and read a good book, and they ski. So look at what is it in your life that you are not going to really care enough about to invest energy, and consider it done. Even if it's a book, you know how often you accumulate books or you start them and you're not really interested? Drop it.
I'm a health coach and a body worker, and I have lots of clients who are addicted to sleeping pills. And I noticed that you mentioned that here. Could you just talk about that a little bit and how I should advise them?
So, first of all, I think we need a campaign to stop allowing the advertising of sleeping pills on television. We are one of only two countries in the world, New Zealand being the other one, that allows advertising of sleeping pills. Because you have all these amazing, beautiful pictures of people walking in fields carefree while some soothing voice is reading 92 incredibly dangerous warning symptoms. Like, you know, you may commit suicide or you may... You may feel tired the next day. If you read them, I have them in the book. Or you may get in your car and kill somebody without realizing it. But hey, you're going to get some sleep. So people go immediately to sleeping pills because they don't realize how many alternative, natural ways there are to go to sleep. And I have dedicated an entire section to alternative ways to get to sleep. Ranging from acupuncture, breathing, meditation, hot baths, to if you have like an extreme case of insomnia, it has been proven that cognitive behavioral therapy is as effective without adverse consequences. So it's kind of lazy to me to go to a sleeping pill. And it's also ignorant. I'm not talking about occasionally, like, you know, you have a traumatic experience, you're very jet-lagged. I'm talking about chronically. I'm talking about people who take a sleeping pill every night and cannot sleep otherwise. The consequences of that are very dangerous in terms of your health, in terms of the propensity for Alzheimer's. You'll see, you'll read all the data and the facts. And then it's like realizing there are alternative ways. And I think there are scientists now at UCLA, like Jerome Siegel, who think that we'll wake up one day and feel about sleeping pills the way we feel about tobacco.
I love this discussion. It's such an important message. But to create a true sleep revolution, I feel this message is targeted at the 1%, at the well-off community. How are you going to make it a true revolution for all the people?
That's a very good point. I have a whole section in the book about that. And actually, 10 days ago, I held a clinic in Harlem in a church to talk to people who are struggling to put food on the table, who have two or three jobs, about sleep and to answer their questions. And the most heartbreaking thing about that is that a lot of the people I talked to really believed that the fact that they were only sleeping for 4 hours a night and that they were exhausted the next day, it was their fault. That somehow if they were like the high-energy, high-flying people they had read about on Wall Street, they would be able to do their life on 4 hours of sleep. But what was very obvious is that even with two or three jobs, they had discretionary time that they were misusing. And let me give you an example. There was this woman whom actually we then had on Dr. Oz's show to talk about it, who was a pastry chef and a babysitter. She had two jobs. And she said to me, I come home at the end of my jobs, and this is my time. This is the time for me to watch my shows. And she said, so I will watch my favorite shows for 4 hours, and then I fall asleep watching television. And then the television would wake her up at some point. And then she said, I would have trouble going back to sleep, and I would go to the kitchen and eat sweets. So she was in her 30s, overweight, with diabetes. So you see the vicious cycle. Now, there's a lot that has to be done at the political level, you know, with minimum wage, with job availability. But sleep is something available and free if only we increase awareness about its value, which means actually you cannot watch your shows. I mean, I haven't watched House of Cards. I mean, I would love to. I mean, I've watched one episode so that people, I can understand what they're talking about. But I'm prioritizing sleep. And what I said to her is, please prioritize sleep. No TV when you get back. Do some transition. Go to sleep. Because if you are going to be sleep deprived, your body craves all the wrong things. We've all been there. Your body craves carbs and sugar. And just this simple thing, she came and talked to us how it's begun to transform her life.
My question in particular pertains to young people who don't have a lot of control in a lot of ways over their schedules. How would a young person go about affecting this change in paradigm that is required to for this sleep revolution?
Well, let's take college students. I mean, these are one of the most sleep-deprived and stressed-out young demographic. And the reason why they're so sleep-deprived is not that they don't have control over their schedule. They have a lot of control over their schedule. It's that they have FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. And they feel that they have not, if they're not on, if they're not checking social media compulsively and refreshing to see if they got two more likes, you know, they are going to be left behind. And I think part of the lesson here is that we are missing out when we do that. We are missing out on our lives. We are sleepwalking through our lives. And if you talk to people who've created these digital technologies, they will tell you, after a glass of wine, that they intended it to be addictive. It's not an accident. It's not an accident that we are all seeking self-validation through social media and become compulsive about it. And that's why we need to kind of set boundaries ourselves, because otherwise these technologies were intended to completely invade our lives and consume more and more of our lives. And that often comes at the expense of our sleep.
Thank you so much, Ariana and Catherine. Thank you all for coming. Thank you so much.